Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 20th, 2017, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we are hosting a courthouse steps discussion on the oral arguments and general information for Jessner v. Arab Bank. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I am the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor William R. Casto, who is the Paul Whitford Horn Professor at Texas Tech University. We also have Professor Samuel Stryker, who is the Dwight D. Upperman Professor of Law, Director of the Center for Labor and Employment Law, and Co-Director at the Institute of Judicial Administration at the New York University School of Law. After our speakers give their remarks, we will turn to an audience Q&A. So as they speak, please be getting your questions in order. Thank you both for speaking with us. Professor Casto, I believe the floor is yours.
Well, that's great. Hey, gang, I'm glad we're all together to learn something more about the Alien Tort Statute. My idea is for us to learn some stuff today and have fun, but in the special definition of fun that lawyers and law students and law professors use. I assume you're all more or less familiar with the Alien Tort Statute enacted over, 200 years ago that provides subject matter jurisdiction in which an alien sues someone in a tort only for violation of international law. Basically, we know all the history, right? It lay dormant until 1980 when the Second Circuit said, oh, there's a cause of action. It was a very heart-wrenching case. A police chief in Paraguay tortured a man's son to death, and the man found the police chief in New York City and sued him. It's interesting that in that case, the executive branch of the United States government fully endorsed the concept of a tort action for violation of international law, and the court so held. Now, Congress subsequently endorsed the idea by codifying FILARTIGA in the TVPA. I think we can simplify our understanding of what's going on if we just take out the TVPA. We're not going to talk about the TVPA today. That's the Torture Victim Protection Act. I think it's also helpful to have an example when we're talking about how these causes of action work. For example, everyone agrees that slavery violates international law and that slavery is a principle designed to protect human beings. You hear this is a very strange hybrid cause of action, and a good way to think of this cause of action analytically is to remember, you can't have a cause of action unless, one, the defendant has violated some law, and two, there is a remedy like damages. In ATS cases, you have to prove that the defendant has violated some law. The law is international law, okay? Then you have to prove that a remedy is available, which is entirely separate from whether a law has been violated. And typically under international law, there are no private remedies. International law typically deals with states. And individual states are expected to implement international law principles through domestic legislation or domestic law, like criminal law, or the ATS is an example of a civil remedy that implements international law. Now, if you read or heard the oral argument in Jesner, you noticed that they talked about a stage one and a stage two. And is something relevant to stage one, or is it relevant to stage two? That turns out to be a very simple concept. Stage one simply is, did the defendant violate a principle of international law? Do you see that's the first part of a cause of action? Did the defendant violate a principle of international law? Stage two is, should you receive a remedy? Now, when we look at, and by the way, I hope that if I overrun my time, someone will step in and say, oh, your time's up. I have no problem with that because I definitely want us to get to Q&A. Do you see stage two is whether there should be a remedy? Stage one is international law. The United States lacks any authority whatsoever to legislate principles of international law. That comes from international law. The remedy is a domestic issue. The United States has ample power to decide how to provide a domestic remedy in this situation. Now, in the Jesner case, for example, the stage one analysis would be, is terrorism a violation of international law? I kind of think it is. Some people might argue that it's not. But the stage two issue, should there be a remedy? There are all sorts of limitations on whether or not there should be a remedy. One such limitation is that, oh, you know what? A federal court should not give a remedy unless the principle of international law is clear. That's a way of getting the federal courts out of providing remedies for a putative international law violation that might not be a violation. So it has to be clear, okay? In addition, there should be no remedy if the United States, in effect, is providing a remedy for a dispute that arose in a foreign country between a foreigner, between two foreigners. That's called one foreigner harms another foreigner in a foreign country. That's called the foreign cube concept. And Kiobel, the Supreme Court case, said you can't do that. By the way, it strikes me that the Jesner case, I think, involves a classic foreign cube case, which should be dismissed on the basis of extraterritoriality. By the way, that's also the apparent position of the executive branch in the oral argument. They say shouldn't reach the issue of corporate liability. This is a foreign cube case which should be dismissed. Hey, there are other limitations, like, for example, you have to get in personam jurisdiction over a party. There's a very vague official immunity context that could be a tort defense. And I take the position that, and have taken in writing the position that, a federal court in shaping a remedy should be very careful about providing a remedy if the State Department or the executive branch has said in this case a remedy would not be appropriate. In other words, a suggestion from the State Department. Now, let's get to the corporate law issue. One argument is corporate law, is a corporation liable? If that's a stage one issue, then there are a lot of arguments that says, yeah, corporations, there's no international law on the liability of corporations. It doesn't exist. On the other hand, if it's a stage two issue, a remedial issue, then that's within the discretion of domestic countries. Now, notice about tort law. You know, tort involves conduct. It's literally impossible for a corporation to commit a tort. No corporation ever has or ever will, because corporations are legal fictions. They don't exist. They act through agents. And so we have always in the United States, and by the way, everywhere in the world, said that if an employee of a corporation commits a tort, the corporation has to pay for the tort. Do you see, that's not a straight regulation of conduct. Rather, it's saying who will pay for the tort. The idea is if a tort is committed to further business interests, the corporation should pay. That's what the law has always been in the United States. Hey, we're talking about a tort action for the 21st century. Surely a tort action in the 21st century should be governed by 21st century principles and policies. Certainly not by what people thought tort actions were 200 years ago. I guess I'm in favor of corporate liability for the simple reason that it's a matter of allocating who has to pay. But we always have to be very careful. As the United States government said in the Jesner case, there are all sorts of other limitations that will limit almost all the horror cases. That's sort of an introduction to the idea. I would love to hear what Professor Stryker has to say.
Wes, should I come in now?
Yes, please.
Professor Casto is a great scholar in the area and a terrific communicator. I very much welcome his remarks, and I think I agree with a good number of them, but not all of them. A couple of minor points, and then I have a little bit of a presentation of my own. I think the Torture Victim Protection Act is highly relevant, not to be cut out of the picture, because it's the one place where Congress directly dealt with human rights offenses and expressly did not provide for entity liability, and I'll bring it into the discussion later on. I think I also agree with the stage one and stage two framework, but stage one includes not only a principle, a norm standing alone, but it includes the question of who may be liable for breaching that norm. And therefore, we think that the class of defendants is part of the scope of liability and does not go to remedy, as the Supreme Court has decided in other analogous cases. Tort law for the 21st century, I welcome such a tort law. I don't believe that the Alien Tort Act is that statute. The Alien Tort Act was meant to address a narrower set of considerations. Let's go back a little bit to 1789. We have a fledgling republic. It hardly has a navy, certainly doesn't have a standing army. It was in no position nor had any intent to dictate morality to the world. Could not conceivably have been the purpose of the statute. So I disagree with some commentators who believe that the purpose of the statute is to go after pirates worldwide. I don't believe there's any basis for that. The concern that animated Congress and also animated the drafters of Article 3 of the Constitution was how to prevent acts of violence being committed on U.S. soil against foreign nationals, typically by U.S. Nationals, from turning into a just cause for war because we were unable to promptly remedy those acts of violence. Now, in the Confederation period, the nation had to rely on the states, and the states were extremely slow, if not obdurate, in dealing with these incidents. So Congress and the framers of the Constitution felt they had to address this concern. They addressed it in the following ways. The Marbois incident, which the court in Sosa says was an important incident that led to the ATS, was actually addressed by Article 3 of the Constitution and the 1789 Judiciary Act, providing for original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court in, quote, all cases affecting ambassadors. Acts of piracy were adjudicated in the Admiralty Courts. They were typically in rem actions. jurisdiction and admiralty was authorized by Article 3 and by the Judiciary Act. Then the following year, in 1790, the Crimes Act, Congress expanded the criminal penalties against pirates and, interestingly, against confederates of pirates. No discussion of entities, but of confederates of pirates. In the ATS itself, Congress dealt with a narrow but important issue, that is providing jurisdiction, federal jurisdiction, irrespective of the mountain controversy, for acts of violence committed on U.S. soil, typically by U.S. nationals, against aliens from other countries. There's also a treaty clause in the ATS, which might have broadened the scope a little bit. We can talk about that if there are any questions about it. There's no basis, contrary to what academics have written about this, no basis to view the ATS as a warrant for the United States to act as a paladin or a Don Quixote of the world, righting all international wrongs. Its purpose, its office, was limited to torts committed on U.S. territory where the U.S. has a sovereign duty to provide a remedy. Now, if you take a look at the complaint in Jessner, everything that is alleged to have occurred occurred either in Israel, the West Bank, or Gaza. No breach of the duty of the United States is even alleged, and indeed, most of the factual allegations in the complaint assert that that the bank has violated U.S. law and regulations. So it's not a breach of a U.S. duty case, it's a breach of U.S. law and regulations case. And given the absence of a duty, I believe there is no, should be no ATS cause of action. And Sosa is not to the contrary. Sosa did not deal with this issue. Sosa went off on the ground that the principle in that case, wrongful detention, did not rise to the level of universal acceptance as a matter of international law. It was not specific, universal, and obligatory enough. Now, turning, I happen to agree with Professor Castro that the case could be decided on the absence of duty theory that I've just suggested, or could be decided on the ground that the Alien Tort Act requires that a U.S. defendant be involved, which is not true here. Or it could be decided also on the extraterritoriality grounds of Kyobo. But on corporate liability, and I think the court wants to decide corporate liability because it granted cert also in Kyobo 1 to decide corporate liability, ended up not deciding it, so I think there's a likelihood that it will. My view is that, and I think it's almost similar to Mr. Castro, but different in the following sense. Stage 1 and Stage 2 is right. Stage 2 is about remedy, things like statute of limitations and that sort of thing. Whether a cause of action survives someone's death. Stage 1 is about not only the norms, not only the principles. In our system, norms do not stand alone. It is about the class of defendants that can be sued. The class of defendants have to be capable of violating international law. So we believe there's an international law dimension to the issue of who can be sued, who can violate, who can commit a violation of the law of nations. Now, on that point, there simply is not a consensus of the international community. You know, the two times when they really got together as an international community in Nuremberg and with respect to the Rome Treaty, they specifically did not provide for entity liability. Even corporate liability in the civil matters was even addressed by the negotiators, but they couldn't come to agreement on it. And if you look at the writings of the UN Human Rights Council, they readily concede there's a wide diversity of views and not yet a consensus on whether or not corporations are suable as a matter of international law. But even if we look to domestic law, it seems to me that the two most persuasive analogies, one are the TVPA, the Torture Victim Protection Act, which is extremely close to the subject matter of the ATS, where entity liability was not adopted. It's not part of the statute. In fact, the irony of the position that people like Professor Castro take is that aliens have broader causes of actions under the ATS than U.S. nationals have under the Torture Victim Protection Act. Seemingly an anomalous state of affairs. The second area for analogy that we think would be highly relevant is what the Supreme Court has done under the Bivens cause of action, which is sort of similar to the argument we just heard. The court has jurisdiction. It has to decide the scope of the cause of action, with which we agree. But the scope of the cause of action, stage one inquiry, includes not only the principles, they're supplied by the Fourth Amendment in these cases typically, but also who can be sued. So hence the Supreme Court in Malesko decides corporations cannot be sued under the Bivens cause of action. Why? because the court views the cause of action as principally focused on the activity, the mens rea of the principal wrongdoer. And that is what we think the ATS also does. Now, the international community may be moving to a consensus, universal recognition of corporate liability in civil and maybe criminal matters, but they haven't gotten there yet. By their own word, they acknowledge that. And in fact, when you look at it, and another document where the international community did focus on entity liability, they did a far more nuanced, calibrated job than the blunderbuss of using the ATS. Article 5 of the Terrorism Financing Convention authorizes the signatory states to create a cause of action for entity liability, but it limits entity liability to the legal entity that is located in the territory or organized under the laws of that state, and situations where the person responsible for the control of the corporation committed the offense. That's a much more nuanced, calibrated proposition, and this is actually maybe the best evidence of universal of international community thought on the point at this point. That's all I have for now.
Thank you very much for those remarks. If you both are ready, we can go ahead and move to an audience Q&A.
Ready.
Wonderful.
I'm ready.
Great to hear. Well, in a moment, you will all hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait on our first audience question, professors, I do have to ask, the oral arguments occurred on Wednesday this week. Do you have any comments on what occurred there?
Well, when I read it, it's hard to make out where people are leaning on oral arguments. Oral arguments are basically to explore issues. I think some of the justices had a clear understanding about what stage one and stage two is. And some of the justices may not have been fully conversant with the fact that the Alien Tort Statute is a subject matter jurisdiction statute and simply does not at all in any way create a cause of action. So I thought it was an honest exploration of issues. I'm damned if I know what their decision will be.
My sense is the two justices arguably in play are Justice Kennedy and the Chief. I heard from Justice Gorsuch views similar to the views that I articulated regarding the need for a breach of a duty of the United States in his question. And he also had questions about whether in 1789 it would have been constitutional to provide for a cause of action by one alien against another alien. And hence, is that a conceivable way of reading the ATS? But I didn't have a good sense of where Justice Kennedy and Justice Kennedy, I believe, joined in Kiobel. He wrote a separate opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a good sense of what he would do in this case. I was actually at the oral argument, not from listening to it. And the Chief.
Well, thank you for your observations. Audience, if you'd like to ask a question, the queue is currently open.
Hi, my name is Chris Lindeneu. Question for our two panelists. It seems that on so many subjects these days that we have some difficulty finding common ground between the left and the right. Is this an area of topic generally, one in which you believe that we have more common ground, that we're not quite so polarized as we are in other subjects, both today and historically as we consider this question of suing entities that are foreign for actions that they've undertaken elsewhere or in the United States? Thank you.
Well, Chris, if I can attempt an answer. As I was suggesting in referring to the Terrorism Financing Convention, I think there are a great many places where there can be agreement on an appropriately designed cause of action against corporate entities. For me, this is a question of judicial process, What do we do with this, 200 years old statute that for most of its history wasn't even invoked? And are we using it now for a whole host of matters that it's not well designed for? So I don't think it's a disagreement on underlying principles that there's an important role for international law in setting rules of conduct and that states should be receptive to their responsibilities. I for one, do not act. And actually, I agree with a lot of what Bill Castro said. But, the question really is a judicial legal process one. What do we do with the 1789 statute?
Yeah, this is Bill Castro. Hey, first of all, we can't just categorize people as left or right. Things
break down
very, very fast, right? I think the basic concern among honest-thinking conservatives and liberals is, to what extent should we empower the federal courts to create these causes of action? Conservatives, and it's a very proper position, say that that's really a legislative decision. It should be left to Congress. Liberals would say, at least I say, it is a legislative decision. But we have this statute on the books. We have Congress agreeing that there should be such a cause of action in the TVPA. And we have the executive branch sometimes saying, yes, there should be a cause of action, sometimes not. When we talk about foreign policy considerations, we have to understand that the executive branch foreign policy varies from administration to administration. So, but again, the basic conflict among people who are, honest thinking people is, are the federal courts going too far? Should this be something left to the legislative branches?
Thank you. I have a follow-up given the paucity of questions. I don't feel badly asking another one. It's a little open-ended, but I am curious as to both of your views on this. I think each of you in your presentations referred to there not being being definite agreement in the international community under customary international law as to whether certain actions in particular, certain terroristic type of activity as being a violation of international law or not. And my sense of the reason why you said that is that certain of the, in particular, unaligned states, as we've called them over time, have articulated the views to say that that there are freedom fighter movements and the like, and certain actions associated with supporting those movements are not necessarily a violation of customary international law. Should we be giving, in your view, freedoms for rogue states or others to make those sort of arguments so that when we consider what is or isn't a violation, we perhaps give it too much credence? Look forward to your responses. Thank you.
Bill, do you want to take that?
Oh, sure. Let's talk about Jesner. You've heard the statement, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist, right? There is an issue in Jesner as to whether terrorism violates international law. I would be willing to argue that it is, that it does. But notice, in an ATS case, you can't just have a good argument. You have to establish a consensus that within the world that this particular activity is contrary to international law. That's an incredibly important limitation upon the powers of the federal courts to fashion a remedy, upon the propriety of fashioning a remedy. ATS is not a blunderbuss. There are the extraterritoriality limitation is very significant. And this rule that there has to be not just a good argument, but a clear consensus. So if there's a clear consensus, then why shouldn't the then there is a clear consensus. And that leads us on to the remedy. Go ahead.
I could just come into this. Chris, I think you raise a very important question, which is the position that the international community should take the so-called freedom fighters. I think my own personal view, and I've written about this, I think there are very serious problems with legitimating the use of terrorism against private individuals who are not part of the army or part of the armed conflict. And that should be reached, but it's got to be reached in the right way, which is initially through international meetings and to try to come up with principles that make sense and have them enforced. There's something along the lines of the Terrorism Financing Convention, but not using this 1789 statute, which everyone looks into it and they see the beauty of their souls. But it simply cannot work for all of these purposes. It had a very limited purpose when it was enacted, and if the alien versus alien view that has been presented was ever litigated in 1789, it would have been held unconstitutional, because the view of law of nations at the time was that it was local law, not an arising under law. But we've changed our view of the law of nations since then. So I think it has a limited office, and I think Congress should be vigilant about dealing with this issue, and the United States and international bodies, but not through the context of this statute and adjudicating the reach of this statute.
Thank you both of you for your replies. I would just say, not so much in reply to what you said, but just as a standalone comment, not focused on the particular statute in question, and that is that when we think of what I would call probably the two most fundamental aspects of the laws of war. One is differentiating between combatants and non-combatants, which is most relevant here, and the second being proportionality. But those entities that are focused on terrorism, which is to say to go after non-combatants and perhaps also to do so in disproportional ways, if they're not going to whether through international conventions or decisions or the like, say they're not that they believe that is wrong, we're not ever going to get to the point where, as an international community, we say that is a violation. So all I'm getting at is, I don't necessarily have the sort of final answer on it, but I'm very uncomfortable giving credit, so to speak, as a veto those entities that support, either are engaged in or support others who are engaged in that sort of conduct that goes to me to the essence of what we as an international community say is problematic. Thank you.
I think you've raised very interesting questions.
I agree.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, caller, for your questions. For the audience, the queue is currently open. If you'd like to ask a question, remember, just enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. Until we get to our next audience question, I do have a question for our speakers today. If a cause of action is granted, do you think that the floodgates of litigation would open?
Well, I think there's been a substantial opening of the floodgates, and they've been closed a little bit because of Kiobel. It's hard to say, because we don't know fully what the reach of the presumption against extraterritorial application, how far that will go. I would like to see the flood become a trickle, by and large. I think cases should be limited to cases where the U.S. Is alleged to have violated a duty to owe to another state, bringing it back to the paradigm that led to the enactment of the statute. There are lots of doctrines, as Bill points out, that can be used to cut back on litigation. The ingenuity of U.S. plaintiff lawyers may know no bounds, so it's hard to say what the impact is going to be over time. If the court accepts corporate liability, we're going to have a spurt for sure. Most of these cases are cases against the corporation. I think almost all of them are. Then there are going to be issues about the scienter standard, because very few of these cases involve corporations as the direct wrongdoer. Usually the claims are based on accessory liability, aiding and abetting liability. The question will be, what is the scienter standard for it? Accessorial liability. Is it enough that you know that bad things are going on and you provide assistance knowing that bad things are going on, or do you have to join in the unlawful enterprise? We had a case a while back involving Canada and the Sudan where, as far as I could tell, the only thing the Canadian corporation did was build a road, but they knew that there were bad actors in Sudan and they continued building the road. That's basically the case. Now, Sudan was not a country that we couldn't deal with, that Canadians couldn't deal with. and the ATS was brought in not to go after Sudan or after the terrorists themselves, but to attempt to reach the corporation for continuing to build the road. So I don't know. It really, a lot depends on how stringent the presumption against extraterritoriality will be in practice.
Yeah, I agree with much of what you said, but there's this notion involving duty of the United States that was created by two fine scholars, Balea and Clark, and they were cited in the oral argument. The problem is that sort of spurious legal history, they came up with a very plausible argument, and it fits the words of the statute. Therefore, they say that's what the purpose of the statute is. The problem is there is no evidence in recorded history that anyone in the founding generation ever said or thought that that was the purpose of the statute. It's just a plausible argument. It's equally plausible that no one ever thought about it one way or another.
Well, Bill, it was the overriding concern of the framing foundation.
I'm talking about
generation.
ATS. Yeah.
Well, ATS was part of the Judiciary Act. It was why they provided for original jurisdiction over ambassadors.
Okay.
You know, it's true that the ATS itself, given its remarkable rebirth, there is very little, absolutely direct legislative history on that. That I agree with. But
exactly.
The purpose of the Framing Foundation is very clear. It is not a single hint that was meant to be, cause of action for violations of human rights worldwide. Not a hint. All the evidence is to the contrary, I think.
Yeah. And again, so you see, things change. There was no concept of international human rights 200 years ago. Hey, look at the diversity statute giving diversity jurisdiction. It didn't address whether corporations are citizens of the United States under diversity. Does that mean that they can't be sued under the diversity statute? 100 years later, the Congress rectified the problem.
Right.
You have to work
I don't think a statute is an ongoing convention. Now, maybe you're going to call me conservative for that. I take this view with respect to statutes that promote liberal causes and statutes that promote conservative causes. I think you have to read the statute in light of its text and its purpose. It's just not an ongoing convention. It's just pour into it whatever content we want. I think you agree with that in principle.
I agree that, in fact, that is the concept of statutory interpretation that most lawyers use. You pour into it what you think is appropriate in today's society. But I want to talk about the flood of litigation. In fact, there's not this Jesner case, as the executive branch said, is a pretty clear foreign cube case, I believe. And also notice this.
And I agree, by the way.
We have all these ways of restricting the cause of action. What about a cause of action in which a United States corporation uses slave labor in a third world country to extract resources of some nature and brings those resources back to the United States to compete against other corporations in the market system? There would be no cause of action under your theory, even though that clearly implicates a situation where there should be a cause of action. We shouldn't allow interference.
I think we currently have rules, international trade rules, as well as domestic law that would bar the importation of such products. And if we don't, that's where you do it. That's where you make the change. So again, it's the legal process point. We take this blunderbuss of the 1789 statute, the one-line statute, and make it do all the work of what we think is desirable policy in the United States. I just don't think it is.
That's fair enough. Again, though, to repeat, it's not a blunderbuss. It has been severely limited by very appropriate interpretations of the cause of action.
Well, one of those limitations is now being reexamined. That's one of the reasons for because this is something that we argued as amici in Talisman Energy, and the Second Circuit ultimately embraced it. And one of these major breaks is now you know, being reexamined.
Mm-hmm.
There are no questions currently in the queue. I do want to inform our audience that our next telephone conference call is scheduled for Monday, October 23rd at 2 p.m. It'll be titled Rethinking Policies on Campus Rape. It is hosted by our Civil Rights Practice Group. Please keep an eye out for these emails announcing upcoming telephone calls, and you can see a full roster of these on our website at fedsoc.org. As well,
if it's okay with you, Wes, I would like to thank Bill for his careful work in the field and for participating in this forum.
Oh, the feeling is mutual.
Of course, and the Federal Society holds that in mutual as well. I'd like to thank you both for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org, and really, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.